This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 2013 Blue Ruin. This movie is directed by Jeremy Saulnier, written by Jeremy Saulnier, produced by Tyler Byrne, Richard Pete, Vincent Savino, Alex Orr, Anish Savjani, and many others as this movie was kickstarted. This movie starring Macon Blair, Devon Rattray, Amy Hargreaves, Kevin Colak, Eve Plum, and David W. Thompson. Cinematography by Jeremy Saulnier, edited by Julia Block, music by Brooke Blair and Will Blair, produced by Film Science and Neighborhood Watch Films, distributed by Radius TWC. This movie has a running time of 90 minutes, and it was made for a budget of $420,000. Allegedly, this movie raked about $1 million at the box office. How are you, Ricky?
I am good. How are you, Mr. Umbar?
I'm all right. In this week's episode, we have a very special guest. The Phantom that puts the manic in Manic Movie Monday. The host with the most, Aaron Goldfrapp.
I guess at this point it's Aaron Gobrales, so I mean, you guys did wake me up. It is 6:24 in the shithole of Florida that I live in, but yes,
that is me. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
We're all right. Listen, did we get it right with your Irish heritage?
No.
Oh shit!
I was born on St. Patrick's Day.
Okay.
I come from a big Spanish family.
Okay.
And this is just God's problem. Here.
With your name, yeah. Your hair color, and your complexion.
Absolutely.
That's what,
my hair color is right out of a bottle. I pay a woman an insane amount of money to look this good.
That's not natural, that red?
I don't even know what my natural hair color is. I have no idea.
Okay.
And my skin tone is, I think, my father's problem at this point. I come from a big Spanish family, so... Yeah,
but
it's fun when people do that because it's like, oh, you must be Irish. And I was like, nah, I'm just a really hot-headed Hispanic. So,
fair enough. Do you speak any Spanish? Any Castellano?
Fuck no. Absolutely not.
So, okay.
We were raised around it, but we never got to sit down and do it. The whole family's from Asturias, Spain.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool.
And yeah, I know. I spoke French in high school. Yeah, go fucking figure. You know?
I'm sorry to hear that.
I know.
Je suis désolé.
Yeah, yeah. Je suis désolé indeed. Yeah.
So, a quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what's this movie about?
Isn't revenge ugly? Well, you're about to sit through 90 minutes of how ugly it could be. And to quote the final song, No Regrets, if it should be, I say that he calls me today, well, I have no regrets for this life I live.
That's not a bad synopsis. Well done.
Well, actually, after like hearing that song at the end, I had a little chuckle to myself because, of course, doo-wop at the end of the heavy affair that you put yourself through. But the song pretty much sums up the whole movie. And I was just listening to the song and I was going, that's my summary for today. There we go. Just use the song.
I gotta complain about something. I really don't want any of you to snipe this factoid from me. And it's completely out of place, but I know you will. I know you'll steal it. Oh, by the way, factoids are spelled just like that on the show. Factoids. Sex toys from the future.
Mm-hmm. Love that.
But okay. I have to put it on the table. And I think you guys know already what this is. There's a big one here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big one. All right. Devon Rattray.
Devon Rattray?
Yeah. Oh, Aaron's smiling already. I want it. So I put it on the table right away. It was Buzz. In fucking Home Alone. He was Macaulay Culkin's older brother, the prick. Yes. And as I'm watching the movie, you guys didn't know this?
Oh, yes. I know what you mean. Yeah.
But okay. I didn't put I didn't put 2 and 12 together because of his later appearances in other films, including he was in a single episode of Better Call Saul. And so I associated that.
It's an Adamo stuff. Like, I had a sense of recognition when I saw him, but I was just looking for factoids today, and I didn't find the factoid. I just went to his bio on IMDb and scrolled down and went, Home Alone? It's like, oh, fuck. It was like... My head exploded. And then I went to look at videos of Buzz. And Buzz, I mean, there's a top 5 Buzz moments on YouTube. Oh, so it's not just a marginal car. He had some good lines.
Don't you know how to knock phlegm wad?
Can I sleep in your room? I don't want to sleep on the hide bed with Fuller. If he has something to drink, he'll wet the bed.
I wouldn't let you sleep in my room if you were growing on my ass.
So, Steve isn't here. I was going to ask the question. You asked the question, Ricky.
Oh, what is your history with this movie, Aaron?
Can you?
Oh, my goodness. I have zero history with this film. I walked into this completely blind. This was 100% a blind watch for me. I knew nothing about it. I was very excited to find out it was on Tubi. Because like if Tubi didn't exist, we wouldn't even have a show, really. Because we love getting our movies from Tubi. But no, I had never seen it before. Didn't read anything about it. Just went in completely blind and was just hooked, enthralled from jump. And my fiance, you know, was sitting there dicking around on his phone, as men do, and he kind of leaned over and was like, "This is fucking good." And I was like,
"Yes,
you son of a bitch! What's the matter? The CIA got you pushing too many pencils?"
Gonna tell Aunt Mary about Uncle John. Candy has a music, but he has a lot of fun.
How long did it take him before he fucking put the phone on the coffee table?
Not long at all. You know, he was like, "I'm in."
Nice.
That's nice. Usually when my fiance says "I'm in," that's usually like, "Okay, we're doing this, right?" And I didn't even. I mean, I took notes afterwards, but at the moment, I was so into it that I was just, "No, I don't want to take notes." Oh, normally, what will happen is I will watch the movie, take the notes, and then at night when I, you know, take my shot of ZQL, I read information online, like factoids and stuff like that, and go to sleep. So
I'm glad you didn't, because you know, Jeff came on the show last week. He came on with fucking 3 pages of notes. Yeah, if you go on social media, you can see that I had sex with those notes. So, yeah, apparently it's a fetish now. So, but no. I literally took a picture. I'll send it to you later. I took a picture of Jeff notes with some lotion and a roll of toilet paper next to it.
I was going
to
say, better that fetish than the foot fetish.
Here we go. Now, for our listeners, what are we talking about? I'm going to put a screenshot, if Aaron doesn't mind, of our conversation. Did you see Ricky's eyebrows going up into his forehead? Well, we were talking, this is way before, I suggested, "Hey, Aaron, why don't you come on the show and join us for an episode?" I sent her some pictures, and then I realized that I didn't really gave her enough context. So I sent her 3 screenshots of Rosanna Arquette's feet. But she didn't know anything about these feet. So she goes, "Are those yours or your girlfriend?" And before I even replied, she goes, "I'm into it either way." It's fucking amazing. Can I use the screenshot for our listeners? Can I do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice one. But anyway, I'm glad the Screen Divers managed to hand this gift to you. And we are waiting for you to return the favor soon.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, when this movie came out, I think I watched this in a daze. I can't remember if it was still our party years, I'm pretty sure. It could have been a Sunday morning or no sleep after clubbing. Came home and watched it. And I remember watching it, and I remember the parallels that I drew to Straw Dogs, which we're going to talk about later. But and actually, on my viewing, that perception has changed completely. I think this is a very revisionistic revenge/revision of revenge movie. It's quite unique in that way as well. but that's what we're here to discuss. And I thought that Anna joined me on that screening, but she didn't. So rewatching it today was a fresh view. It was almost a fresh view. But I have seen it before, and over the years I've recommended this movie while I was forgetting about it. So it was enjoyable, very enjoyable. But I think I did watch it before general release, actually. Mm-hmm. I watched it in 2013, right after it got kickstarted.
Wow.
Sriki, what's it?
So this, I must have been working at FOP, which I've spoken about before, and I must have been seeing the posters up all over London.
Could you illuminate our guests and our listeners on what FOP
I used to work at a very, what can I say, a very artisanal sort of DVD and vinyl store. So one of those stores that first originally were like, oh, we only hold foreign cinema. Oh, we only hold independent movies. Oh, yes, did you know we have Blu-rays now? And all of that stuff. So I saw the posters and, of course, indie film all up in London. So I was like, oh, shall I go watch this in the cinema or not? I think a little bit of time went. I think I heard a Mark Kermode review of it. And then I finally decided to watch it. And probably the same as Umber, it was probably one of those Sunday morning after having too much fun the night before and just putting it on. And I remember it was during an era where I would watch things like Chopper to help me on the come down, if you know what I mean. So...
But seriously, Nave, like, how you holding for cash? I'm a bit bloody broke.
Listen, mate, what are you talking about?
Cash.
There's no cash here. Here, there's no cash, all right? Cash, no. Robbo?
No cash.
I'll tell you what. You try getting from where you're sitting to the front door. Because I reckon I could shoot you from where you're sitting to the front door. Because that's about as long as you've got to produce some money for me right now. I'll give you 20 seconds to produce some cash, or else I'll fucking shoot you. One,
hey,
two,
I've got no
three,
cash, mate. Four.
And
that was your inspiration to move to Australia, right? Chopper rib.
Chopper, yeah. Oh, you know, been clubbing all night and still haven't gone to sleep. But you know what? Some South Australian Aussies beating the crap out of each other. I'm up for it. So this kind of fit into that genre of films for mm-hmm. me. And I think I didn't watch it again until now. And yes, this second viewing of it, not in that haze, not in that environment, not in that part of my lifestyle, much different.
There's a ton of symbolism I completely missed the first time I watched this. Mm. And it's almost heavy-handed, but it was welcome. I don't know why, because obviously there's a lack of dialogue. So you need that emphasis being placed by certain sequences. And something that it reminded me of other stuff in other media, for example, reminded me of Silent Hill. There's a bit when the car, the Blue Ruin, which by the way, like a fucking idiot, I found myself going, why is the movie called Blue Ruin? And Anna looks at me going, the car. Like, oh yeah, the car. Which by the way, the end of this movie as well kind of hits you in the face with it. It's like, yeah. But what is this movie about? I think this movie is about many things, but it's about generational hate and how it's passed on. Like a racism is thought, you know, like that kind of shit. It's passed on, usually by your fucking parents. What do you think, Aaron?
I mean, I really think it's just about a man who would rather slaughter an entire family than spend one more night in a Pontiac Bonneville. I mean, I've been homeless, but I was homeless in a Nissan. It's a little different. It's a little different. No, I truly believe that it is about the cycles that repeat themselves and how also if you don't deal with that hate and that anger, it will come back to bite you in the ass. Like much like in Don't Look Now, where it's about unresolved grief and how the grief eventually will kill you. That's exactly how it is. And I think that there is a stigma attached to men getting help for their mental health issues, getting help for their grief, getting help for, you know, these different issues. And so I think as a result of that, unfortunately, a good portion of men, at least in America, I will say, I don't know, you guys are probably A-okay, but here in the States.
We are, because what I'm hearing is men and women. I know what you mean, though. Yeah. Like, it's, yeah. I think it's...
But I mean, because the main protagonist is a male, what I got from that is just that is a big issue.
It is. It's emphasized by his sister. It's emphasized by his sister. His sister says to him, you're weak. Remember that? Says, no, you're weak. She's like, what's the matter? Ricky, what the fuck's the matter? Is there a fly?
There's a fly.
Okay,
a
Aaron, fly. You don't know this, but Ricky has a phobia of flies.
I haven't got a phobia. I've got a deep-seated hatred for them that makes me want to, like...
Wait, you learn nothing from this movie?
No, yeah, this is exactly like Blue Ruin. You know, like, there's a fly. Where's my M15 or 14 or whatever it is?
My Blue Ruin is German cockroaches. So I'm totally okay with, like, flies and spiders and centipedes, which is not really a thing here, but it is a thing in New York. Scorpions, totally fine. Snakes, totally fine. I don't have a fear of heights. I have a deep-seated hatred and or anxiety attached to German cockroaches. We just had to do a German cockroach clean out. Really disturbing to know that that's a thing that exterminators ask you to do. And I lost most of the kitchen. I had to replace that this weekend. And it was horrifying.
But it's a hot state, right? That's the environment they thrive in.
I couldn't go into my kitchen and eat because I had it in my head that everything was Creepshow.
Fuck. Right. Listen, that's part of the reason where they're, because I have it as well. It's my only, it's funny that you touched the nerve, and I have two memories of that, and that was Creepshow. Mm-hmm. But that's not where it comes from. Mm-hmm. Where it comes from is we had a boiler room and a one-way door, and I got locked into the boiler room, and when I looked for the switch in the dark, I hit the switch, and the fucking floor went.
Pfft. Yep.
Because this was, you know, Rome in the middle of the summer in a hot, humid place, and that fucked me for life because there's nothing else I fear. Myself and Annie are divers, you know, we dive down to 40 meters. I could touch any creature, whatever. Spiders, I don't give a shit about spiders. I live in Australia and you live in Florida, so there you go. It's but that's my what's it called, the Achilles heel or your sword or Damocles or whatever the fuck you want to call it. It's that's
it is.
Yeah, that.
It is my Achilles heel. No, indeed. So yeah, I get it. You know what I mean? Like I am ready with a big book.
Yeah, my wife is very big on, you know, not harming these creatures. So I have now got a system where I have to catch them, and I have become very good at it. But I have basically passed on generational trauma to my kids. they're like, quick, close the door because there'll be a fly in here and dad will have to come around with a glass. And so it's...
Fuck, I mean, I'm going to call social services. Someone's got to fucking save these kids, man. I got to tell you.
my son's turning 7 and my daughter's just turned 4 and they've already got generational trauma around flies being in the house.
Aaron, it's also sand, so that you know, it's sand and flies. Yeah, so it's fucking
sand, flies, and saliva. Which is, which my 4-year-old has worked out and has started, like, blowing raspberries in my face with saliva, like, so that saliva's flying out of her mouth, because she knows that I can't handle that. I'm like, I need you to step back, and she's like, ha 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 ha. I'm like, ooh! So what I want to start off with is, you know, a lot of people give There Will Be Blood one of the biggest nods to the fact that the first 20 minutes, 50 minutes is completely silent. This film starts with an almost speechless protagonist throughout the whole, almost half an hour, I think, until he sees his sister, there's barely a word uttered from him. Because even when the cop's talking at him, he's barely saying anything. I think he just says, I won't go into people's houses. I think that's all he says in the first 20-odd minutes. And it creates this very eerie, suspenseful feeling that gets you set up for what you're about to be exposed to. And I remember the first time I watched this, and it's probably why, Umbar, you've promoted this film so many times to other people, is that I did not expect how violent the first killing would be. It's so visceral.
And it's embedded in fucking true realism as well. And that's what I love about this movie. Like the attack in the stall, but that's not even like what, like this time the full level of immersion was achieved when he tries to fucking punch her one of the tires. It's exactly what happens.
And the hand.
Yeah, you get this illusion of, oh yeah, have you ever fucking tried to do that? And he's doing it in a state of panic on top of it. So it's visceral. That cut, if you ever cut your hand like that, everyone has done at some point. It's brutal. Not only that, but by this stage, you are with Dwight. Because another thing that I completely forgot about this movie, the entire movie, it's from his point of view. It's him. So the viewer, you are with him. That doesn't mean that you're sympathizing with him.
Right.
Most of the time you are. But it took until the end of the movie for me to notice the first thing that this movie subverts, which is when it comes down to revenge. You rarely see a movie where someone's trying to avenge, as an adult, his parents. Hmm. Usually it's a kid or like it's, and this or time around it was like, what the fuck is going on? Yeah, or a wife. Yeah, exactly. And also, I love the fact that, I think it was Jeff that mentioned this on the Unforgiven episode. He said how much he values an instance in which the narrative allows for the exposition to unfold for the viewer without fucking bashing you over the head with it. You know, text across the screen to tell you time and place. It's the equivalent to that, right? It's annoying. It's annoying. And a lot of modern media does that because it's, I don't know, whatever it is, but it's, everything is so algorithmic that if you need to appeal to, I don't mean to be an elitist when I say this, but anything that has mass media appeal is designed for that. So it will have to kind of, it has such a broad spectrum that if you wanted to hit all demographics, it needs to dumb things down a little because it falls into, it becomes general entertainment. So, but this isn't even in the same galaxy. It's a different story. In fact, as proof of that, this movie had to be kickstarted because no one wanted to put money in it because it's the antithesis of that, you know, generic kind of algorithm media. And yes, this is a world before streaming services exploded. It was the inception of it. But after the pandemic, it was game over. It was game over. People didn't go to the movies anymore. It just fucking changed the world. But anyway, to go back to this movie, when it comes down to the revenge kind of cycle, it doesn't, everything this man does is the result of inexperience. It's the confusion that he experiences, the grief, the unresolved grief. I love the fact that even via the narrative, you're actually not given that. It's not black and white. How much time has passed? You don't need to really know that. You just know that it's a long time. It's been a long time. You're given a hint, but it doesn't matter. Because otherwise you'll start judging the character on those bases. And the movie doesn't want you to do that, I think. But when it comes down to the exposition, the first example, because as the viewer, it was bothering me almost, but then I kind of enjoyed the fact that I had to do that. When he meets his sister, you start questioning, is it his sister? Is it his ex-wife? Is it... You don't fucking know. It's not black and white, not at the beginning. It took like that entire interlude felt like an eternity for me. And then I asked Anne, because she was the other viewer during the, and I said, do you know? And she goes, no, I don't know. I was like, but it doesn't matter. We'll find out. And the movie allowed it to happen naturally. Everything you find out about these people happened naturally. It doesn't overload you with exposition you don't fucking need. You'll find out when you need to. Even what the cop is saying to him at the beginning fades to nothing, right?
To white noise. To replicate how his brain is now. To replicate how he's not really part of society. To replicate the fact that almost everything that connects him to a social world is fuzzy. There's like barely any, like, and that's, I think that's why those scenes are early on are really important, of him dumpster diving, of him living in, like him breaking into houses just to have a bath. That is really just showing how disconnected from society he is. Mm. And this event forces him to readdress the fact that he has to, for him to perform these acts for the rest of the film, he has to reintegrate in society somewhat. Anyway, I feel like we're railroading our guest. Erin, what are your thoughts?
That's cute. So a lot of it, like, it kind of took me back to losing my father. You know, my father passed away roughly 7 years ago, and probably more at this point. Sometimes you just lose track, you know, and how everything was fuzzy and how people were bombarding with funeral arrangements and what about this and what about this and what about this, and you are just, it is wah, 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 you know, it is white noise, really. I really love the fact that as an actor, Macon Blair is he's sort of the antithesis of a revenge hero, whatever you want to call him, protagonist that you see in most movies. You know, he's not Bruce Willis in Pulp Fiction. He's not a particularly like rough character like you would see on like an episode of Justified or something. He's not. He has a very small voice. He has a very the way he speaks is almost deliberate but hesitant at the same time. So he's clearly an introvert, which, I mean, when you live on the streets, you do become an introvert. You kind of have to, because you have to be out of the mainstream, right? Because your main goal is very animalistic. It's very much like, I need food, I need shelter, I need to take
survival.
Yeah, and that's, you know, trust me, showering goes way out the fucking window when you think about, like, or surviving. and so to see him perform these very violent acts, there's a level, I think, of understanding that I had where I was just like, yeah, no, man, I get it. You know, like I, and also it depends on your relationship with your family also, you know, because I'm very close with my family. Spanish families are very odd in the sense that you go, you get married, right? And then something happens and you move back in with your parents to take care of them until they die. It's very specific for you to take care of the elders until they pass away. So I have a very close-knit type family. And the more people die in our family, the closer-knit we get, right? So I can only imagine watching this, how hurt his sister is, you know, when she's just like, why didn't you say hello? Like, why didn't you come up to me when you saw me? And, you know, his, you know, rationalization, justification is, you know, I didn't want you to see me like that. Right. Mm. Or I was not, how does he put it? He says something to the effect of like, I wasn't right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It does act out like a person who doesn't have the tools to deal with something.
Absolutely. Know, and
most people don't. When shit goes down, if, particularly grief, I don't think you get better at it. You don't get better at it.
No, I think I had a lot of anger and I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. You know, and it was coming out, you know, as we say in recovery, because I mean, you guys joke about your party days. I had party days too. Tomorrow marks 17 years of sobriety. So,
well done.
Congratulations.
Awesome. So, I mean, sorry. That is worth reflecting on. It's day at a time, all of that stuff. Yep.
Yeah, all the good stuff, right? So like one of the things that you learn is that if you don't deal with your feelings, they come out sideways. Whether that manifests itself in violence, it manifests itself in losing all of your friends, it manifests itself in sabotaging relationships, other addictions come to play, that kind of thing. So
we lived through it as well. Don't worry.
Yeah, so I very much understood that deep seething hatred of something and wanting to, I think, somewhat in Dwight's case, there's a point where you just want to make sense of it all. And there's a finalization where you just want it to be done. You know, you want all the answers, right? Like, and I feel like Dwight has that. I feel like Dwight has that very much. Just, you know, it's like, okay, well, if I kill so and so, you know, then it's done, right? Mm. Then I can move out of the Pontiac Bonneville. Clearly, my problems will be solved. You know, but I feel like it's this domino effect.
It is. And the movie has a very, very, very sad ending.
Because I was going to add to that, it's whatever happens to Dwight, I feel like it happens to the audience as well. Because all the questions you want to ask of Dwight that you can't because you're an audience member just viewing on to this, the film kind of, as Umbar said earlier, it doesn't hold your hand. So as he talks about information, that's the first time the audience finds out about the information. So as much as you want to ask questions of Dwight, Dwight is only figuring out the questions, let alone the answers, as he's going through. There's several moments of mystery throughout this film that it doesn't tell you what the mystery is until there's a sudden moment where he's talking to someone and this question comes out of him and you're suddenly like, oh, I didn't even know that these people didn't know that, or I didn't even know that Dwight didn't even think about that or whatnot. Again, I'm trying my hardest not to spoil this film because I might be spoiling my rating towards the end, but this is definitely a film that needs to be experienced. This is one of those films that if you listening to our podcast and you're like, oh, I don't know whether to watch it or not, just go and have a try. Have a trial of it. It's a very interesting film. I would say probably why this film didn't get as many accolades as it probably should have. Not only was it a kickstarted indie film, but you had quite a few revenge films out in this period of time. So Prisoners was out the same year. Only God Forgives, which means that prior to this, Drive was out. Kill List was out 2 years before this. There was a lot of revenge cinema going on at this moment in time.
Yeah, this one stands out, though. I mean, the only thing that it really pays homage to heavily to a certain extent, and then it subverts the rest. Aaron, you were mentioning how the archetype doesn't fit the generic kind of, or the that macho kind of framework for the hero in a movie. And I think that, thank God for that. But I had to look back at a much maligned movie for many reasons, because it is a disaster. By today's standards, it's a disaster. And it actually, there was a lot of critical uproar as well when it came out, because the portrayal of women in it was extremely misogynistic, which is Straw Dogs. And that's another story. But the archetype was very akin to this one, with the difference that there's a duality to that character, which is quite simple. It goes from being meek and, you said the words, introverted, but not the idea of virility and masculinity and aggression, which is played by, what's his name? Dustin Hoffman, right?
Mm.
But then when he goes in full revenge mode, it becomes the embodiment of all those, you know, toxic traits of male masculinity. And even by different standards, by 1970 standards, that movie caused a fuss. And today, by today's standards as well, it's hard to watch because of that. Because you don't really have to read about it to spot what the director was doing there. And it's a different story. But, for example, to go back to why Devin Rattray and how he got casted in this movie, playing Ben, which, by the way, fantastic portrayal of
a such gun, a,
you know, it's very believable, like the entire thing. When, and I love that, I love the fact that when he's walking across the car park, he's going, Ben, and I was shouting at the screen, I was going, he's got headphones on, man, he's got headphones, he can't hear you. And Anna's going, yeah, you're right. That's why I don't go to the movies, so I can do that in our house. This is fine. But when he gets there, his reaction, you can see a veteran actor, because that's one thing that is taken away from child actors. They've been at it for a long fucking time. And guess what? When you do something over and over again, unless you decide to go into the music industry and you do a Corey Feldman or whatever the fuck his name is. My God, man, the guy's a nightmare. But anyway, in this instance, this guy is such a good character actor. He plays that role to the T, dude. And even, again, the exposition giving you, like, it's standing the exposition dump. There's one sentence about their previous friendship, and it paints a world for you, which is, hey, I found that photo. Do you remember of us with the stripper? And we were terrified. You basically gave me a season of Freaks and Geeks with that. You know what I mean? You gave me a season of The Wonder Years, and I got it from one fucking sentence. I loved it. Absolutely loved that bit. Even the entire thing of why. Why is he asking him to burn the Polaroid? Because he's a good friend. It's like, I don't want you. I don't want anything to be tied back to me so you don't get in trouble. And it's unspoken. It's that, and he takes his fucking battery, not because he needs one, but because he doesn't want him to follow the help. Because that's exactly what happens. It's the subtlety in all of this. I don't even know if it's an homage to Michael Mann, but again, I haven't seen such a big tribute to the fucking color blue, which I don't like. Blue is the color I like the least. But it's that teal, right? And here, it's peppered throughout. And I was trying to give a deeper meaning. I'm asking you guys, did you, because I was like, I saw it at the end, and we'll talk about when we get, we tiptoe around the ending here.
Yes, please.
Because we don't want to spoil it. So we're not going to mention certain things, right? We're in agreement of that. Are we going to manage?
Yeah. But I was going to say, the base feeling, isn't it? That blue is what? Melancholy, you know?
Is that what you got?
Yeah, it's the whole film is melancholy, isn't it? It's that whole dripping feeling.
Are you fucking wearing blue?
Of course I am. AJ, everybody, this is my AJ Styles wrestling t-shirt, and of course it has a little bit of blue for our Blue Ruin episode. I thought I'd come a little bit themed.
I'm wearing purple. So.
Oh, there we go.
Anna is purple crazy. That's her favorite color.
That's our me and my fiance.
Purple
same,
power.
Same favorite color. So I really loved the portrayal of Ben, because he could have been this very stereotypical alpha red pill guy, and he wasn't. He was, you know, he just happens to be a former Marine, right? He just happens to be someone who is a quote gun enthusiast, you know, but who also has, you know, good trigger discipline. You know, he's not just like some idiot that goes out in the forest and, you know,
I love the fact that you pointed that out when he says to the guy, he had to point a gun at you. Do you remember that before he?
Yeah, absolutely. He's wonderful. He's wonderfully understated in this. And obviously in stark contrast to Home Alone, you know, where he has to play this like brash, dickhead, bully guy, right? Whereas
I took a screenshot. I got to show you guys. Wait a second. I took a screenshot because once I found out it was him, I was like, oh my God, are there connections to Home Alone here? Was the director like a big fan of Home Alone? And turns out he was. Mm-hmm. But you would say that, right?
Right.
Apparently, when David Redray went to the audition, he didn't make the connection. The director didn't make the connection. They told him after. It's funny. But as I was watching the top five buzz moments from Home Alone today, hey, I'm constipated. What can I tell you? I found a screenshot. No, actually, no. I was watching it and I went, oh, there you go. You know, I had that Leonardo DiCaprio moment in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Let me see if I can write that.
Yeah, it's the back of Buzz's head.
Yep.
It's Buzz's bedroom in Home Alone, and he's got a rifle over the bed.
He's got the BB gun rifle, yeah.
So there you go. Is this what happened to Buzz?
So clearly, Buzz got some fucking therapy. right, to deal with Diddy Dog,
Diddy Dog, because
because he becomes. Have you seen Sweet Home Alone? Is that what the last Home Alone was called, where he turns up as a security guard and he still has a rifle? No, you guys didn't watch it. I did.
Wow. Well, you have children.
So. Yeah, he's the only returning character in Sweet Home Alone that got came out.
What the
out
fuck is Sweet Home Alone?
It was a Disney Plus channel revival of Home Alone.
You can ignore that. That is a prank call. Over.
Prank call?
Yep. Listen, when I was a kid, my family went on vacation. We forgot my little brother, Kevin. Twice. He called in the 289 to mess with me. The idiot does it every year.
You sure about that?
Yes, I'm sure about that. I know for a fact that there is no forgotten child at that address. I was just there for a bogus home alarm call, okay? Guess what? The place had a McAllister home alarm system. Oh, gee. Is that a coincidence? I don't think so.
Wow. And no Macaulay Culkin,
no Macaulay Culkin, none of that. It had, I will read the list later on, or you can look it up yourself. I actually found out that there is an internet movie firearms database, and
for your boner violence needs.
For if you want to find out more about firearms.
I'm not fucking with you. I'm going to go for a smoke. Interrupted. How about that? That's what you've done. Fuck you.
So the first thing that you saw was an E-Col Viper, which is what Dwight pulls out of the glove box of a car that he breaks the window of, and that one has a lock on it, and he can't break off the lock, but, you know, he gets rid of the gun straight away. So there we go. A Rudger GP100 is one of the films, or one of the two guns found in the household towards the end. A Smith & Wesson Model 3 was seen as a replica in the gun cabinet. Crossman 3357 revolver. But we really want to know about the rifles, because those are the ones that I used the most throughout this film. So the first rifle, I've referred to it before as a Rudger Mini 14 or an M14. It probably shoots either a .45 cartridge or a 0.410 shot shells as well. It can house both. And then, of course, there is also a second gun that it is likening to. However, it's probably a Tortorosa Rossi circuit judge. So those are some of the guns that you see in the film. Thank you, Steve. Thank you for coming back for that single segment.
That's the thing, though, is that I previously in my former life, if you will, like I dated a gun enthusiast red pill dude that became more red pill after Trump got elected,
mm-hmm.
because it became socially acceptable to, you know, to hate women and brandish your guns, right? So that was what I was kind of expecting when I was watching this. I saw the guns, I saw the mossy oak overalls, and I went, oh, flashback.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And, but then he turns out to be such a sympathetic character, but also kind of like this is what you need to do. If you are going to do this, which clearly I cannot talk you out of it. Thought about calling the cops, remember, because his kind of military training kicks in and he kind of goes, yeah, you know, but he didn't, because clearly they have a really deep bond together, even though they haven't seen each other in a certain period of time. It just clicks right back. It's right back to where they start. You know what I mean? Like where it's almost this unspoken brotherly connection that they have, where they're just kind of, they can kind of like just look at each other and know, okay, I can't talk you out of this, but what I can do is I can teach you how to shoot. I can teach you proper trigger discipline, so that if you are going to do this, which I don't agree with, but if you are going to do this, then you're going to be prepared. And then, of course, obviously, he gives them the greatest piece of advice, and which obviously is not taken, but But I love that he's just like, this is what you need to do. You know, it's not a very, like, when they meet again, they're not like, you know, like, remember the time we used to light our farts? You know, like, it's not like, there's no moments of levity there other than them talking about the stripper. And, you know, which is in and of itself awkward.
It's also highlighting that it's been a long time. It seems that he disappeared on many people's lives, including Ben's life, it seems. You know, so the friendship rekindles immediately, but it was left off. So we can assume, again, the viewer has to assume that a long time has passed. You don't need to know how long, but we're talking a decade, if not longer, actually. But I don't know. You were talking just now about the expertise that Ben displays. Mm. He even said, I don't know if you guys talked about it. I took off for a moment there. Don't mention guns again. Fucking hell. You just gave this tool to Steve. We're not going to hear the end of it, Ricky.
Oh, somebody had to do it. Somebody left a comment. Somebody left a comment that we haven't got any gun info. So here we go.
This is going to be the only episode where I won't tell Steve to go and listen to the episode. Hopefully he doesn't. But anyway, there's another bit given to us when the expertise the band displays are highlighted when he goes, I have 16 acres, because he's seeing what's coming next, which is, if you get him, you're getting him on my property. You know what I mean? And that's, again, so he brings legality to a certain extent into all of this to try and help him.
And then a later comment comes up being like, oh, I'm really sorry. You know, I had to wait. And it's all of that little information that, you know, he's like sat down and read and been like, how legal is it for me to off a person on my own property? You know, there's like those little nuggets, those little factoids all over the place.
As somebody who, like I said, I was in a very serious relationship with a gun enthusiast / red pill / misogynistic / alpha, all of the things, right?
I'm so sorry.
It was a long time ago. And like I said, it changed. It didn't start that way. It started, you know, it started off.
What's your partner's name now?
My partner now is Slink.
Slink.
Yeah. Good on you, Slink.
We love to meet him one day.
Yeah, when I met Slink, Slink was like, no uterus, no opinion. And I was like, I'm going to fuck you so hard. Yeah.
And you did.
Take this uterus. Take this uterus in your face.
It was like, yeah, fucking liberal, hot. You know, I was
shit,
all over.
Man. Anyway, in regards to this movie, and it's peppered with symbolisms, stuff that I didn't notice on my first viewing, because I possibly, again, I was slightly dazed back then, and I was also younger. You know, this is fucking 12 years have passed. I'm a different person. You know, every 7 years, apparently, your cell structure changes. You're another person, right? But in this instance, there's so many symbolisms that I didn't pick up on from different media that resonated with me, with us, with all Gen X here. I think, Ricky, you're not like you're...
I'm a millennial. I am a millennial.
Yeah, but the spirit, you're Gen X.
Totally.
You're cool, man. You're cool. You're right.
I got in under the wire. So, yeah.
Yes. But when it comes down to other media that it's kind of referenced, stuff that I picked up on, for example, and... It kind of marks a different act in the movie, because this movie, when it comes down to its structure, and that's why it works, because you can't go completely astray of any structure because it's unusual already. When it comes down to its narrative, it does have a first act, second act, and a third act. And they're very defined. But there's one, visually speaking, and this is still when the movie is completely benefiting from no dialogue. Because now the movie visually, it's speaking a particular language to you and you're learning it very fast. It's when the car, when Blue Ruin, when he's driving through the country, there's a sense of melancholia through that. And there's like a shoegazy track in the background and it's perfect. But the car kind of disappears into this fog. And you know, that's what the movie's doing there. For me, it was marking the point of no return. That's it's getting fucking lost in it now. And you're there. You're there as a passenger, you know, but there's enough distance. You're not in the car. You could be in the car. It's not. So you're still removed enough to still experience this viewing and not identify with him. So from a visual standpoint, that's done in a masterful way. But the way that car disappeared into the fog, into the mist or whatever. It's more mist than fog. It reminded me of Silent Hill, too. Was from a narrative standpoint, that game changed in video games, for example, that changed the way narrative unfolded for a gamer. You know, it's such an iconic. If you've played it, you know, they made a fucking movie out of it. So the movie doesn't hold a candle to the source, but that's one of the defining points. And then there are others. I don't know how we're going to tiptoe around one of the. I want to mention it. It's at the end, so I'm going to be careful.
Mm hmm.
The color blue, we talked about the color blue. And I was trying to, just like you probably, and many other viewers that are going to experience this, hopefully our listeners are going to go and experience this movie, because we can agree that we all recommend it, right?
Sure.
There you go. What's the name of a particular character? We're not going to say what he represents in this movie, because it will spoil it. David Thompson is the actor. And it's worth mentioning his name. He's a character actor. He's not, you know, never at the moment, he's not lead material, but it's not that memorable either. But perhaps you go and look for him in other works by the same director and Macon, because we're going to talk about their expertise and their work as well. Macon is not just an actor. He actually happened to direct a movie that we mentioned on this podcast before.
Because you questioned me about this in the last time that this came up. And it's now, I had it on the tip of my tongue because I was like, he's going to so totally ask me this. And now it's all gone again because, of course, I wasn't
Melanie
thinking
about Linsky
it.
Melanie Linsky is one of the
two
leads.
And Elijah Woods. Elijah Woods? Am I right?
Yes. Aaron, you're good. Good. We were talking about? Are we going to get there together?
I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
Exactly. Aaron, you've seen it? Have you seen it?
Yeah, but I can't.
It was a Netflix production. I think it came out in, was it 2000? You said it last time on the show.
2017, yes.
It's worth watching. And that was directed by Macon. It was directed by Macon Blair. And if you look at the credits of this movie as well, his brother's involved, the other brother's involved. One of them is an editor, so they keep it in the family. Mm-hmm. And I'm not surprised that this movie works because it is very familial. This is a familial fucking tragedy that's of epic proportions, you know. We used the word generational earlier, and this movie does that, you know, conveys that perfectly. But what am I talking about? There's a moment towards the end, you'll see a shot of someone walking away. And that someone is...
It's William.
It's William.
And we're not going to say what he is, but he's wearing a gray hoodie, and under the hoodie, you get a sliver of the T-shirt he's wearing, and the T-shirt is blue. So I thought, you just see part of it. And the emphatic nature of the last few words uttered in this movie that I did not get the first fucking time around, I got it this time, though. It's him repeating it three times. I was like, why is he saying that? And then this morning I woke up and went, oh, shit, I got it. He goes, the keys are in the car, which means this is going to continue. You know, it's a very, very sad ending. There's no resolution. Like you said earlier, Aaron, the protagonist doesn't learn anything here. He becomes a cautionary tale, but it's...
Well, I would... I know that you're saying the protagonist doesn't learn anything, but I feel like he does get some sort of resolution by the end of the film. But his path was always leading to a chasm, a cliff. But there's a lot he's learnt about revenge. Like he's learnt about almost. Like, what's the point of it? Or like, because there's a moment towards the end of the film where it looks like he's going to stop. There's a moment towards the end of the film where it looks like he's just going to walk away and just be like, I've gotten this far and I'm just going to stop. But again, something pulls him back in. Something that another character says pulls him straight back in. And I feel like he just learns that, in a way, revenge can be essential. You know, revenge can be another mark in your life that you have to push yourself through because if you don't push yourself through, who knows what, who else is going to like feel the rage from all of the bad things you've experienced.
There's a moment, I don't know if you guys had the same feeling, Aaron, because you know, you, your podcast, which by the way we mentioned at the beginning when we introduced you, holy shit, it's a fucking honor to have you on.
Yes, it is.
Well,
yes.
What I would talk, just in case our listeners are fucking missed to this host that, you know, graced us with her presence, is this is Aaron from the Manic Movie Podcast. They've got 140 plus episodes since 2023. If that's not prolific, go fuck yourself. Go look for the fucking meaning of the word prolific. We got to get our shit together, Ricky. This isn't good enough, man.
Hey, man, right, we've only been doing it for a year. We've only been doing it for a year.
We're going to do more, man.
We're doing good. Okay. We're doing good.
But anyway.
I was going to say, just the other thing that really resonated with me, you mentioned the shoegazy track, right? You mentioned there's the scene. It's really one of the only scenes that evokes, emotion in the sense of with music, is what I mean, is that the film itself does not pander using a soundtrack, right?
Thank God, like, for that.
It's not. There are comparisons in the grief processing with a film that I like, but I don't know if I would like it as much if it didn't have the soundtrack, which is Garden State. And it's also a nostalgia watch for me, right?
Because is that Zach Braff?
It is.
Yes.
Was it?
Oh yeah, fucking yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
Because that film came out at a point in time when I was married, and we were in that, we're in our 20s and where's our life going kind of bullshit. It meant something different. But I think one of the reasons that I have a tendency to really enjoy it is the soundtrack, is that every single song, and even Zach Braff said this, so this is not necessarily just, me thinking this, but is that every single song was curated specifically so that it would evoke a certain amount of emotion during each scene. Very much as if I fucking hate this pretentious expression, but like, the music is a character all itself, you know. The soundtrack is just as important. So, evocative, right? And he even said that when he would send the script to people who he was trying to court to do the film, he would send a copy of the soundtrack with a little blurb about each song. So I liked the fact that the movie didn't pander like that. It wasn't like, here we're gonna play the Simon and Garfunkel song, good luck, not crying, you baby, and it didn't do that. And so I think we, it's that great Anais Nin quote, right? It's like, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. And we view films often, at least I do, I view films often through the expense of the lens of my own experience, right? So obviously this film resonated with me in my grief and that way, right? Whereas I think it resonated with Slink, in that Slink is from, the hard streets of Jersey. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up on a street, but I am not the eternal tough talking South Jersey badass that he is, right? So for him, he gets that anger. He gets that revenge feeling. He gets that,
tickle a couple of things, but I got to say, in this instance, have you talked to Slink after the movie about this?
Oh yeah, no, we talked about this, and I.
What did he say to you?
He pretty much said, his family is all gone. His family is deceased. Everybody is deceased. So, for him, he was like, if somebody messed with my family, I get it, And then he also got Ben's advice, and is one of those people that, like I said, I've never been in a fist fight, but Slink is 6'6" and he has indeed been in quite a few fist fights. So for him, there was a, there was kind of a like, yeah, like I would do that, whereas me, I would be like, I don't know. And I've thought about that, because I've thought about my loyalty to my family, right? And like how that is, right? And especially in the Spanish culture, it's its own animal, trust me.
So do you know, living in London as has a benefit. And the benefit is that it's a cosmopolis, right? So London is not the rest of England. And if there's a party or if there's a gathering, if you look around the room, everyone at that party that is, you know, that contains myself and Anne will be from a different part of the world. Like last night we went out for dinner and there was a Greek person there, there was a French person there, there was an Australian person there, there was an Italian person there. And it's, and nobody gives a shit where you're from, right? But a lot of our friends are from Spain as well. So I can completely relate to what you're saying. It's it's our reality kind of thing all the time. So I can sympathize with that. There's one thing that I wanted to, that I want you to discuss with Slink after this podcast, you get a chance, or just at least ask him, because I'm curious. Now you can tell me. How old is Slink? Is he late
40s? We're both 45.
There you go. Young.
You're what, 48?
I'm fucking 48, man.
It's dude. So, fuck you.
I just wanted to say that for a moment. Oh, fuck you.
We are in the same weird.
At the moment, man, I feel older because of this fucking sciatica bullshit. Both. But anyway. Yeah, we are the same generation, and because I thought about it as well. If someone that didn't have a support system like a family, like for example, in your instance, Ricky, you have a family, right? And generationally speaking, you have the mind of a Gen X, and you are on the threshold when it comes down to your fucking date of birth. Mm. So it doesn't affect you as much. But I can tell you that if you were to place a Gen Z through this, or an early millennial, late millennial, they would have a different type of melancholia. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that is happening at the moment to men, when you say to men, right, I think our generation has learned those lessons, I like to think, unless, and if they haven't, I don't fucking fraternize with those people, they don't exist in my book. I'm sorry. They don't. It's their fucking problem.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I'm not going to try and throw my hands around the world. I have to worry about the close vicinity, you know, of the
absolutely
the growth that is happening in my circle, because we, you know, we're goths anyway, so we already lived in the fringes most of our lives. I don't give a shit. That's why even politics doesn't affect me. You know what I mean? To a certain extent, it does. We have learned how to navigate on the outskirts. So, to a certain extent, right? These things affect you, but when it comes down to what I think. The thing that I had melancholy and nostalgia about is the fact that, and I was reassured at the same time when I had this thought, is the friendship with Ben. Mm. I have friends like that. You have friends like that. And you do too, Ricky. If something was to hit the fan and you show up, I would listen to you and I would go, what do you need me to do? Mm-hmm. And you know this, I know this, and we are, fuck, that's mega privilege. Because there's an entire generation that will never, by modern standards, because society has changed, the fabric of society has changed, they will not get that privilege, and they know it. So there's a lot of loneliness, particularly. I don't think it affects only men. I think it's affecting both sexes. You know, I think it's those bonds are. I don't want to say superficial, because that would imply that the individual is taking part in that, and it's not. It's the fabric of society is unraveling. So it doesn't allow for that type. And that's the sweetest message in this movie, in my opinion. That's why we talked extensively about Ben's character.
Mm.
Because I like to think, Aaron, it seems to me that you had a colorful experience, life experience. That's why you were invited on this pod, by the way. Because I can relate to a certain extent. Yeah, there's affinity, right? We've lived. But it's not because, oh, we're better. No, it's because our fucking generationally, that was kind of allowed. I feel bad. I feel bad for a younger generation. It's not even pity. I think they've been robbed. We talked about generations being robbed on the show before. From music, they've been robbed. From a cultural standpoint, they've been fucking robbed. You used the word chasm earlier, Ricky. It's happening. And it's not their fault. It's just happening. So that helplessness, what I think Slink has experienced watching this movie, if there was, that's when the melancholy and probably the message of the movie took away from that. I don't know, because you described it as it is a male fantasy, like to be able to rise up to the situation, whatever. I didn't get this in this movie. I watch Die Hard if I want that fucking feeling, because
exactly.
That's an every man.
That's not
that,
this film.
You know, endures.
Exactly.
I get that from that movie.
I think that's why I loved it as much as I did, was just because it was that subversion, right? Like what you talked
about. Absolutely.
And also, when he shaved, I was like, oh, he looks like a baby. You know, like he has this baby face, and it just, and then when he put the clothes on, he looked so patently uncomfortable in those clothes.
And you could also, you could tell that he must have lost weight for the role, because those clothes were so ill-fitting, and he was so meek with it. And it's that huge thing where you see him in a horrific scene previously and just about escaping and covered in blood to, I am now shaved and in these ill-fitting clothes and feeling really sheepish right now. And you're like, that's the same guy?
Yeah, he looks like a Bible salesman.
Yeah,
absolutely. But he does. It has khaki pants and fucking yeah. But this, from a visual standpoint, because we talked about this movie not using conventional language by taking, you know, that form of communication away, which is fucking great. I absolutely adore it. It almost allows for discourse. You know, it's an intimate viewing. I actually recommend for this not to be watched with any more than two people. Like, you need, because you will be able to discuss without interfering with the movie, because things unravel at a certain pace. So it kind of allows that discourse almost, I think. To, you know, if you're with your partner, it's, make it as intimate as possible when you watch this. It will hit harder if you can.
Yeah.
And it's better with another person. So if you're lucky enough to have, you know, someone close, that close, you know. Oh, this is a date movie, man. Watch Blue Ruin as a date movie. Date night. This is date night.
Now, the other thing that I found really interesting just with watching it with Slink is that, yes, so both Slink and Hillary, my co-host, my best friend, are both from Jersey. And they are their own.
How you doing?
Animal.
How you doing?
They are their own. They are very much of the, you mess with my family, you mess with my friends, I show up, I don't complain, I will take care of it. Whereas I come from a, like, I will fight beside you, but, like, I'm not the first person to, you know what I mean? But Slink was saying that given the situation with his friends, from, like, the Jersey friends to other friends, it's the same deal. It's like, show up, you look at each other, you just know. And Hill is one of those people who I know personally, with all of the issues that we've been through just in our lives, we're very much of that. And a lot
She's
of that
solid.
Has rubbed off on me because I am that friend. Like, I don't have a very huge friend circle. I do attribute it to both age and sobriety. but a lot of it is that, you know, I have this little garden. And I water each one of those flowers and I keep them very, very close to me and I take care of them. And so, you know, Hillary's husband, Talon, just fell off a roof, you know?
Oh,
and
so
I'm grocery shopping with my mom, you know, and the phone goes off and I look at it. I'm like, what? You know,
what
and
happened?
I,
what happened? Like, what was the result of
the
injury?
Gutters.
No. What was the result of the injury?
Oh, so he was.
Can you talk about it publicly?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. He was up on the roof cleaning the gutters and I guess he slipped, you know, because they have this great house, like huge house. So he was up there, you know, and he fell and shattered his foot, basically.
Fuck.
So she texts me immediately, you know, because Hillary's a texter. She has a phone. So she texts me immediately. I tell my mom, I'm like, I got to go, you know, and I'm like, OK, here's the deal. What do you need me to do? Because we are also business partners. So it is very much like, okay, do I need to handle work orders today? What do we need to do? I'm here. You know, she has, I think really kind of instilled that in me just from watching her. And so then I have, you know, become a better friend to my other friends as a result of just knowing her. And the same thing with Slink is that Slink is very much like, tell me what to do and I'll do it. Like he's very much like a, you know, let's get down to brass tacks. Like, let's do this kind of thing. And whereas, you know, so that has kind of been very influential for the both of us.
And again, you're lucky to have that garden, right? We were just talking earlier about people that don't fucking have the garden and they want one and they ain't going to get one,
exactly.
You know. But hey, the name of Hillary's husband.
Oh, Talon.
Talon, if you're listening to the show.
Get well soon.
please.
Hopefully that all those bones calcify back up again, please.
And yes. The result of this, because like I said, we're all, you know, in connection in one another, and she's like, this is going to break us. She's like, we don't have, because none of us have health insurance. None of us can.
Oh, yeah, you live in the States, damn it.
Okay. So she was saying, she's like, this is gonna break the business. This is gonna break us, right? She's like, I don't know what to do. And magically, through whatever weird, you know, universal intervention had happened, he does not need surgery.
Oh, thank goodness.
Nice.
Oh,
Jesus Christ.
Recover on his,
was it like, Talon? Talon, right?
Yeah, she's like, Talon's
It's a Wolverine. Fucking epic name, dude. Get well soon, Mr. Talon.
Thank you, Talon, for not requiring surgery.
Yeah.
I know.
He sounds like a fucking epic villain, dude.
Yeah.
Hey, we're gonna take Talon down. But anyway, I think it's we're getting to ratings times.
We are
getting
the more
we talk about this fucking epic, the more we are going to spoil it. And we do this.
I do want to connect this to some other films that came out after this, which includes the ones from the makers as well. So we talked about Make and Blair and the film that I've already forgotten again.
Green Room.
Is, no, it wasn't Green Room, but it was the one he directed. But he's also
Hold the Dark.
Hold the Dark.
Okay, before you continue, all right, and then you pick up from there because you're very good at that. Just the other day, and he's going to listen to this. George from Horror Weekly, George, the host of. I talked to him for an hour over the phone, all right? And it wasn't me extending the conversation. It was him, all right? So we talked. It was a fucking great conversation. And we were talking. I said that, you know, Aaron, you were coming on. I said, you're going to have a great time. And I said, we'll see.
You're not wrong, sir.
Hey, I'm having a good time, all right? I'm having a good time. But he mentioned, hey, have you seen Hold the Dark? And he was not a fan. But now I need to watch it because he said that if there's a misfire in what's the name of the director? Not Macon, because you know he co-wrote that as well, probably whatever. But because this guy's a
Thompson.
No, the director,
Jeremy. Jeremy Saulnier.
He said that it's a fucking massive misfire because he's a fan of the book. Is that the movie you're talking about? Hold the Dark.
Yeah, no, I was going to, yes, that one as well, but I was going to talk about I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. I was also going to say, okay, so let me read this out.
Fuck you. Make mouth noises. I'm not
going to. Okay, I'm going to clap and you're going to take it out. There we go.
Stays in. All of this bullshit stays in. Put some music behind your meltdown.
So after Blue Ruin, you had Green Room, you had I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, you had Hold the Dark, which is a little bit on the fence. Macon also is the director of the new Toxic Avenger. Now, again, a sit-on-the-fence sort of film, but wow. I have got it pre-ordered. I am on that.
Hopefully it's so bad it's good. You know, that's what we can hope for. Like, 'cause that's what you want from that, right?
I was going to connect this film to a film that came out much later than this, which is You Were Never Really Here, the Joaquin Phoenix film.
Oh.
And this film, I feel like if this film wasn't created, that film would never exist.
I actually like that, dude.
I love that film. I went to see it in the cinema, and if we do that film in the future, I love it. I love that film.
When?
No, I don't know. Whenever you want to, because it's not next week. We've already got next week's film. So, but it's interesting how this revenge sort of film, or this sort of line of revenge film, where you're following a protagonist and you're not quite sure why the protagonist is taking the steps they're doing, and it slowly gets revealed, doesn't get old. We should have more films like this. We should have where we are blindsided. We are down this tunnel with the protagonist, and we only learn as the protagonist learns, or we only learn as the protagonist wants to reveal that conversation. So anybody listening to this, watch this film, but also follow it up with a great double bill, You Were Never Really Here.
Perhaps another generation will get, I don't know, fucking White Ruin and it's a Prius or something. I don't know. Hopefully. But even then, I don't know. I don't know. You can't beat up a car like you can beat up a Bonneville. Fuck that car. Dude, at one point, I was looking very closely. I was like, did they add rust to it? No. If they did, whether it's like Robotine kind of effects. It's fantastic. It looks like real fucking rust.
I mean, you didn't have to look up the internet movie database on cars this time around. Apart from the stretch. The stretch.
The stretch. What's the stretch? Do it.
Do I have to do it? It's your job to do that.
Come on, you got a million screens.
I've got one screen and several windows. That's what I've got.
Aaron, you do the looking. Come on, do a Steve. We'll guide you through it. Because you might not know this, and we are giving you a great tool. We gave it to another group of podcasters who obviously are listening to this. It's one of my favorite shows, and I'm not just fucking saying that. It's the show in question. It's called In This Episode, Everybody Dies.
Oh, nice.
And just like Manic Movie Monday and Horror Weekly, they were an inspiration for us to start this a year ago. And by the way, this is our 50th episode.
Yes, it is. Congratulations. Happy 50th anniversary.
Thank you. Aaron, I want you to open a tab if you can, and then you get to use this in your
It function. Doesn't matter. I've already opened it.
No, but wait, because she may not know about it. We're gifting this.
Yeah.
Okay. There's the Internet Car Movie Database. So that's ICMDB.
Oh, no, it's IMCDB.
CDB.com.
Internet Movie Car Database.
It won't search the movie. It stops at a certain
point. Oh, okay. Ricky, what is it?
So the limousine is a Mercury Grand Marquis stretch limousine, and it's a 3-star. So it's kind of, it's confirmed.
Even that car's fucking trailer trash, man. Like, there's something about it.
Let's talk about this first. Just a tiny little second. So when they pick them up in the limo, there was a point where Slink and I love just white trash. Like, that's like our porn, right? Like we're just like, oh, these people are horrible, you know.
Hey, but it's not only in fucking Florida. I lived it's everywhere. There's a place everywhere like that. And I can tell you, because he moved to Australia. I lived in suburbia in Victoria, which is where Melbourne is. And if you've ever seen a show like Cat and Kim or whatever, do you remember Cat and Kim?
Yeah.
I live there. I get it. I get every second house is a MATLAB.
I'm currently watching a documentary on the Antwoord called Zeph on Prime.
Oh,
which
yeah,
is, I mean, that's, come on, that's pretty African. Much.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. But anyway, you were saying.
So it's funny because as soon as we saw them, like, he just looks at me and he's like, oh, they're trash. And I'm like,
And the fucking screen door tells you that.
When we meet later on, you know, say the matriarchs, if you will, of the family, you know, and which one of them was from the Brady Bunch, that threw me completely off it. But I was like, these women are terrible. Like,
what'd you say?
Yeah, right. the mom or the head the
matriarch,
the older of the two females that's in there. That's Eve Plum.
The blonde?
She's from Jan? She's Jan. From Brady Bunch.
Oh, fucking God.
Is that the next door neighbor? Is that
that's a deep
is
cut.
That Jan? The next door neighbor?
What's the name of the actress?
I fucking hate that show. But like, it's like the little girl and then the middle child who always like doesn't get a good break. That's Jan and that's Eve Plum. Then above that is...
Oh, my God. Yes.
So to see her in that role, I was like, wow, she plays white trash real good.
I got to ask you something, guys. You know, there's a moment, which, by the way, it's a very defining scene in this movie. And we got to be careful not to spoil this now. But it is when you think that he's learning something. That Ricky, you mentioned that bit. And it's when they're around the answering machine.
Mm.
Oh.
And he's peeking around the corner. There is a moment. Tell me if it was just me. This movie, but because of that visual language, you could take every frame. Like that sequence when he loses control of the car, he gets out of the car, and he's just standing there covered in blood. And then there's the negative space behind him of the road. It's fucking beautiful. You know, it nods at Mad Max. There's nods at 10,000 things in this movie, and they're done tastefully. So it looks really good. But in that sequence, there's a moment in which the three of them are kind of, you see them from behind, and you kind of get like a side shot of him, but they might as well be silhouettes. And they're standing around the, almost twitching. And there's a moment in which I thought, oh shit, they look like Living Dead. They look like... they look like Deadites for a second. It looked, and it kind of... I think it was intentional. If it was not intentional, then it's movie magic because that's the sense I got. Did you get that? Did you get a horror feel from that?
I definitely
felt...
Before
it goes full Tarantino exploitation?
Yeah, I found it very...
Yeah, or like a Strangers, you know?
Yeah. But I also found it very amusing because that's the first proper scene we've had of the antagonist, apart from the one that he has a huge conversation with in the middle of the film. That's the first time we've actually properly seen them and how they interact with the world. Because we keep just catching them in snippets. And then, of course, we saw William for a very short time at the start of the film. But we don't really see the antagonists of this film, or what we're going to call the antagonists, because, you know, this is one of those films with a fine line of who's actually the antagonist. So
some of our viewers or listeners may make the mistake of, because man, a lot of people have suffered on both sides here as well, even if they're trash. Because, again, one party dies almost by mistake, and we're told that. But also, whoever's left off, those are also siblings. So the mother, also out of the picture. Those people should have, that left when they found out about, fuck out. We're trying not to spoil this movie, right?
I think we need to stop.
I think it's ratings times.
Here we go. Okay, so I'm going first. So this film is a 7.8 on my scale. It is, if we talk more about it, I feel like I'm going to give away lots about it. But there's a mood to this. There's a cinematography to this. There are aspects of this that will always be surprising, even if you've seen this film 6 or 7 times. Even though this was only maybe my third viewing of this film, there were still bits that I completely forgot about. And I know it's been probably 10 years since I last saw the film, but it still surprised me. It still had me hankering for more, which is one of the most important parts, I think, of cinema. And it's made me go, you know what? There is a bit of a hole of both the director and the main protagonist of this film that I haven't seen or I haven't experienced recently. So I'm probably going to go and watch those. So 7.8. A 7.8 slash tires on a limousine.
Oh, you piece of shit. You took that away from me. Fuck. I hate this podcast. I hate it. I hate you as well. This 15 years of friendship, this isn't fucking friendship.
I didn't. It's not like I jumped into your brain and I stole something. I totally jumped into your brain and stole something.
Anyway, Aaron.
Yes. So for me, this was a first time watch. I only watched it one time. I feel for me, this is a 9 out of 10. I give this a 9 out of 10. Awkward Polaroids with strippers.
Oh, that's good. That is good.
I really feel, and the only reason I gave it a 9 out of 10 is because the rewatchability factor of it is lower for me, just because I try very hard, you know, to you know, only do real dark shit, you know, maybe like every 6 months, you know, because sometimes I just want to be dark, dude. Sometimes I just want to put
you
on the wall.
You send me that text of approval after watching it going, that was great. I'm like, oh, yes.
Yeah. Like, sometimes I just want to put on, like, you know, The Wall by Pink Floyd and just be like, oh, my God, life is so horrible right now. And sometimes that's just what I want to indulge in, you know. So I this is not a film that I would be like, you know, like, hey, we got a Sunday for you. Want to watch Blue Ruin? You know, I feel like this is not a comfort blanket. No, I feel like this is definitely something that I would recommend to Hillary because, like I said, she brought martyrs to the table. We have a martyrs episode. Yes. Right,
so is this payback?
And I said to her, I said, is it rapey? And she goes, you'll wish it was rape.
No. Yeah, I mean, that's like, that's you know, honest. Yeah,
right. So, so like I said, she's way darker than me. But I would absolutely recommend this movie. 100% 9 out of 10.
She needs to watch it with Talon.
Yeah, absolutely. I really feel like Macon Blair is such an amazing actor. He's one of the few actors I will say of, and I believe he's probably younger than we are. Right? Isn't he younger than we
You know, he's been in big shit as well. Didn't he? Was he in Oppenheimer or some
yeah,
shit?
He was. Like,
yeah.
He's one of the guys at the table.
Yeah.
Right?
So, but he is so expressive without being expressive. You know, like, obviously, he can convey so many different emotions, you know, the melancholy, the grief, all of those things. With just the way he looks, you know, the way he reacts, the way he doesn't react, you know. So, yeah, I'm 100% 9 out of 10 awkward Polaroid pictures with a stripper.
Nice one. Nice one. So, I mean, this was one of, I think when we gave Aaron, we gave you six picks. I think we gave you six picks. And I wasn't going to mention this, but I'm going to.
Oh, are you going to? Because I was going to mention it.
Yeah. You want to mention? Sorry, okay. Your time Absolutely. Is up. I get to fucking tell the story. We originally gave six picks to Aaron when we offered to guest on the show because, you know, it was going to be a great honor, and it is a great honor to have you on. And one of the picks was Don't Look Now, which is one of our favorites, and I can confidently say that all of the screen divers admire that movie from in so many levels. And it's also one of your favorites, if not, you know, in the echelon of one of the best films ever made across genre. It is a depiction of grief that, like no other, to this day people are trying to emulate it. And
whoa,
it's
whoa,
just
whoa,
not...
whoa, whoa! Hold on, we remember.
We're going to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah, no. Okay. Anyway, so, and Blood Ruin was one of the other picks. Now, am I going to tell you what the other four were? Fuck you. No. You don't need to know. Oh, the sausage is made. But in this instance, it was also, I think it was, we killed two birds with one stone here because there's nothing better, for me at least, as a screen diver, and for you as an honorary screen diver, Aaron, because that's where you are now as well. There's no greater pleasure for a cinephile or a film buff to recommend something to somebody else and they truly enjoy it. Because it you know, that window becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, like your taste, it's when you consume a medium to this extent, it just become a little bit more difficult. And it was a pleasure to hear that from, and I believed it when you told me. You know, sometimes it's diplomacy goes out the window and you can confidently say to somebody, you know, the movie was shit. But in this instance, you complimented her and I believed you because it is a very good film in its own right. And it's an anomaly by modern standards in the way this thing even came to fruition. So on this viewing in particular, I got to appreciate it. I can highly recommend it. It is a subversion of the revenge genre because it is a genre in its own. I still think that the Koreans do it best. It's like it's their specialty. But there's history there. You know, I think it's the interaction over the years between Japan and Korea that has caused this. So it's easy to do because it's embedded in their culture. In regards to this, I think it's a compulsory watch. You need to watch it. So for me, this is an 8.5. And 8.5 is pretty high. I actually gave an 8.5 to Unforgiven last week. It's 8.5 blue fanfare tickets / bookmarks.
Nice.
Wow, deep cut. Woo.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky.
And this is Aaron.
Why you couldn't kill a life and expect them to fear? Sure.